left in the camp. Saladin, in his desperate attempt to escape, had taken all four, which meant they had no choice but to walk out of the desert. They took only what they could carry easily. Warm clothing, phones, passports, wallets, and two Kalashnikovs with fully loaded magazines. They didn't bother trying to find a torch among the camp supplies. There was moon enough to light their path. They left the camp at 11:05 local time, and headed due west into a sea of sand. Keller walked at the front of the line, followed by the two women and lastly by Mikhail. In Keller's right hand was Mohammed Bakr's mobile phone. He checked the status of the battery. 12%. "Shit," he said. "Anyone have a charger?" Even Olivia managed to laugh. In Casablanca, Gabriel and Yakov Rosman took quiet stock of what remained of the operation. Its wreckage lay scattered across the desert of southern Morocco, from the Algerian border to the dunes of Erg Chepi. Two Toyota Land Cruisers were smoldering ruins, a third lay damaged on its side, and a fourth, the one presumably carrying a wounded Saladin, a Saladin who looked as though he might require emergency medical treatment, had last been seen speeding northwest toward the Middle Atlas Mountains. Jean-Luc Martel, a prominent if deeply corrupt French businessman, lay dead at a remote camp, along with Mohammed Bakr, Morocco's largest hashish producer, and four of his men. Bakr's mobile phone was now in the possession of a British intelligence officer. The battery meter read 10% and falling fast. "Other than that," said Gabriel, "it all went exactly according to plan."
"Saladin would be dead if the Americans had picked the right car."
Gabriel said nothing.
"You're not thinking about—"
"Of course I am."
Gabriel looked down at the computer screen. On it was a map of southern Morocco. Two blue lights were moving eastward across the desert from Khamnia. A single red light was moving slowly westward. They were approximately 2 miles apart.
"In a few minutes," said Yakov, "the southeastern corner of Morocco is going to be crawling with soldiers and gendarmes. It won't take them long to find a couple of burning Toyotas and a camp full of dead bodies, and then all hell is going to break loose."
"It already has."
"Which is why you need to order the team to dump those weapons and make for the bolt hole at Agadir. With a bit of luck, they'll arrive before dawn, and we'll pull them out right away. If not, they'll lie low in a beach hotel and leave after dark tomorrow night."
"That's the safe play."
"Actually, there's nothing safe about it."
"And us?" asked Gabriel.
"The gendarme will be blocking roads all over the country soon. Better to stay here tonight and leave by plane in the morning. We'll fly to Paris or London and then catch a flight back to Ben-Gurion."
"What about Saladin?"
"He can see to his own travel arrangements."
"That's what I'm afraid of." On the computer screen, the blue lights had reached the red light, and after a moment all three were moving westward across the desert toward the village of Khamnia.
"What are you going to tell them?" asked Yakov.
Gabriel rapidly typed out the message and clicked send. It was four words in length. "Plug in the phone." Chapter 61. The Sahara, Morocco. They had no means for a secure upload, not in the cellular dead zone of the southern desert, so they searched the Samsung the old-fashioned way, call by call, text by text, internet history. Natalie, the team's most fluent speaker and reader of Arabic, handled the device itself while Keller relayed the data to the Casablanca command post over the satellite phone. They were sitting in the back seat of the Nissan Pathfinder, with Dina behind the wheel and Eli Lavon serving as her navigator and spotter. Mikhail was in the Jeep Cherokee with Olivia.
"How is she?" asked Gabriel.
"About as well as you would expect.
We need to get her out of here, tonight if possible."
"I'm working on it. Now give me the next number."
It appeared Mohammed Bakr had not had the Samsung long. The first incoming call listed in the directory was the previous evening at 7:19 p.m. The time corresponded to the call that Jean-Luc Martel had received while sitting with Keller in the bar of the Palais Farage in Fez. So, too, did the number. It seemed that the man who had called Martel to arrange the meeting at the camp in the desert had immediately called Mohammed Bakr to say the meeting was on. Bakr had then placed a call of his own, at 7:21.
"Give me that number," said Gabriel. Keller recited it.
"Read it again."
Keller did.
"That's Nasir Ben Said."
Ben Said was the Moroccan jihadist, an ISIS member who had followed Martel and the team from Casablanca to Fez, and from Fez into the Middle Atlas Mountains.
"Bakker called someone else a few minutes after that," said Keller.
"What's the number?"
Keller related to him.
"Does it appear anywhere else?"
Keller put the question to Natalie, who quickly searched the directories. Bakker had placed another call to the number at 5:17 that afternoon. He had received one at 5:23. Keller relayed the information to Gabriel.
"Who do you suppose that is?"
"The guest of honor?"
Gabriel severed the connection and raised Adrian Carter at Langley over the secure link.
"Where's Nasir Ben Said?" he asked.
"His phone is back in Fez. Whether Nasir is still attached to it is unclear."
Gabriel then gave Carter the number Mohammed Bakker had called three times, once the previous day at 7:21 p.m., and twice that afternoon before the meeting in the desert.
"Any idea who it belongs to?" asked Carter.
"If I had to guess," said Gabriel, "it's Saladin."
"Where did you find it?"
"Directory assistance."
"Why didn't we think of that?"
"I'll give it to the NSA. In the meantime," said Carter, "tell your team not to lose that phone."
20 minutes after they passed the encampment of Berber nomads, Mohammed Bakker's phone reconnected to Morocco's cellular network. It received no old texts or voicemails, and no new communication of any kind. Keller passed the news along to Gabriel and then asked for instructions. Gabriel ordered them to follow the N-13 north to the village of Risani at the edge of the Tafililt oasis. Once there, they were to switch to the N-12 and make their way westward to Agadir.
"I assume Saladin will be waiting for us when we arrive?"
"Doubtful," said Gabriel.
"So why are we going there?"
"Because Agadir is a lot nicer than the Tamara Interrogation Center."
"What about the guns?"
"Dump them in the desert. In all likelihood, you're going to run into roadblocks."
"And if we do?"
"Improvise."
The connection went dead.
"What were his instructions?" asked Elie Levon.
"He wants us to improvise."
"What about the weapons?"
"He thinks we should hang on to them," said Keller.
"Just in case."
It was after midnight by the time they reached the village of Khamlia. As Dina turned north on the N-13, a pair of helicopters thundered overhead on an easterly course.
"Could be a routine patrol," said Keller.
"Could be," said Elie Levon, skeptically.
The Kalashnikov that Keller had taken from the camp was hidden in a duffel bag in the rear storage compartment. The Beretta was at the small of his back. He glanced over his shoulder and saw the headlamps of the Jeep Cherokee trailing about 100 yards behind. He wondered how Olivia would fare during a prolonged interrogation by Moroccan gendarme. Not well, he reckoned. Turning around, he saw flashing emergency lights approaching them at speed. The vehicles sped past in a blur.
"That didn't look good," said Levon. "Are you sure Gabriel doesn't want us to dump the guns?"
Keller didn't answer. He was staring at Mohammed Bakker's phone, which was vibrating in his hand. It was an incoming text message, Arabic script, from the same number Bakker had called that afternoon. Keller held up the device for Natalie to see. Her eyes widened as she read.
"What does it say?" asked Keller.
"He wants to know if we're dead."
"Really?
I wonder who that could be from."
Keller picked up the sat phone and started to dial, but stopped when he saw a gendarme standing in the middle of the highway, a traffic torch in his hand.
"What should I do?" asked Dina.
"By all means," said Keller, "you should stop."
Dina eased to the side of the road and braked to a halt. Behind her, Yossi Gavish did the same in the Jeep Cherokee.
"What should I tell them?" asked Dina.
"Improvise,"
suggested Keller.
"What happens if they don't believe me?"
Keller looked down at the message on Mohammed Bakker's phone.
"If they don't believe you," he said, "they die."
Chapter 62. Risani, Morocco. Dina spoke to the gendarme in German, very quickly and with fear in her voice. She said that she and her friends had been camping in the desert
that there had been explosions of some sort and gunfire. Fearful for their lives, they had fled the camp with only the clothes on their backs.
"In French, madame, please, in French."
"I don't speak French," answered Dina in German.
"English? Yes, I speak English."
But it was so heavily accented she might as well have still been speaking German. Frustrated, the gendarme checked her passport while his partner circled the vehicle slowly. The beam of his torch lingered for a moment on Keller's face, long enough for Keller to consider reaching for the Beretta. Finally, the gendarme moved to the back of the SUV and rapped a knuckle on the glass.
"Open it," he said in Arabic, but his partner overruled him.
He returned Dina's passport and asked where they were planning to go next, and when Dina answered in German, he waved her forward with his red-tipped torch, the Jeep Cherokee, too. Keller handed Bacher's phone to Natalie. "Answer him."
"What should I say?"
"Tell him we're dead, of course."
"But hurry,"
Keller interjected. "We've kept him waiting long enough." Natalie sent a one-word reply, "Ewa." It was the Arabic word for yes. Instantly, the person at the other end of the exchange began working on a reply. It appeared a few seconds later. One word, Arabic script.
"What does it say?" asked Keller.
"Alhamdulillah."
"It means, thanks be to God."
"More or less."
"What it really means," said Keller, "is that we've got him.
Or someone close to him."
"Good enough."
Keller rang Gabriel on the satellite phone and told him what had just transpired. "You might have checked with me before sending that message."
"I didn't have time."
"Keep him talking."
"How?"
"Ask if he's hurt." Keller told Natalie to send the message. A minute passed before the Samsung pinged with a reply.
"He's hurt," she said.
"Ask him if the others were killed in the drone strike," said Gabriel.
"You're pushing it," said Keller.
"Send the message, damn it." Natalie did. The reply was instant. "Many of the brothers were killed," she read.
"Ask him how many brothers are with him."
Natalie typed out the message and sent it.
"Two,"
she said a moment later.
"Are they hurt?"
Another exchange of messages.
"No."
"Does he need a doctor?"
"Easy,"
cautioned Keller.
"Send it,"
snapped Gabriel. The wait for a response was nearly 2 minutes.
"Yes," said Natalie. "He needs one."
There was another silence on the line.
"We need to know where he's going," Gabriel said at last.
"Check the phone," replied Keller.
"If he turns it off, we'll lose him. You have to ask him."
Natalie typed out the message and sent it. The reply was vague.
"Al-Riyad."
"The house."
"We need more than that," said Gabriel.
"You can't ask him which house. Tell him you're sending Nazir to look after him until the doctor arrives."
"I hope you know what you're doing," said Keller.
"Send it." Natalie did. Then she composed a second message and sent it to Nazir Ben Said's number. They had to wait 5 long minutes for their answer.
"We've got him," said Natalie. "He's on his way."
Keller brought the sat phone to his ear.
"You still want us to go to Agadir?"
"Not all of you," answered Gabriel.
"Too bad about those guns. Any chance you can find them?"
"Yeah," said Keller.
"I think I know where to look."
The next call to arrive at the Casablanca command post was from Adrian Carter.
"We had his phone for 3 or 4 minutes, but he went off the air again."
"Yes, I know."
"How?"
"He was talking to us."
"What?"
Gabriel explained.
"Any idea where the house is?"
"I didn't think it was a good idea to ask him. Besides, we have Nazir Ben Said to show us the way."
"He's already on the move," said Carter.
"Where is he?"
"Leaving Fez and heading back to the Middle Atlas."
"Where he will tend to a wounded Saladin," said Gabriel, "until a doctor arrives."
"Are you thinking about making a house call?"
"Office style."
"I'm afraid you'll be on your own."
"Any chance we can borrow one of those drones for surveillance?"
"None whatsoever."
"When's your next satellite pass?"
Carter shouted the question to the officers gathered in the black hole. The answer came back a moment later.
"We'll have a bird over eastern Morocco at 4 a.m.
"Enjoy the show," said Gabriel.
"You're not thinking about going up there, are you?"
"I'm not leaving here without him, Adrian."
"It's the first part of that sentence that concerns me."
Gabriel rang off without another word and looked at Yakov.
"We need to clean this place up and get moving."
Yakov stood stock still.
"You disagree with my decision?"
"No, it's just
you're not worried about the damn jinns, are you?"
"We're not supposed to make noise at night."
Gabriel closed his laptop.
"So we'll leave quietly."
It's better that way.
5 minutes later, the Moroccan armed forces and security services went on their highest state of alert. Nevertheless, in the confusion, they failed to take note of two small but significant movements of personnel and equipment. The first occurred on the outskirts of the village of Rissani, where a Jeep Cherokee and a Nissan Pathfinder paused briefly in the night at the intersection of two desert highways. There ensued a one-for-one exchange of passengers, a small bookish man for a tall, lanky one. Then the vehicles went their separate ways. The Jeep Cherokee headed west toward the sea, the Nissan north toward the base of the Atlas Mountains. The passengers of the Cherokee knew what awaited them, but those riding in the Nissan were headed toward a more uncertain fate. They had in their possession two Beretta pistols, two Kalashnikov assault rifles, passports, credit cards, cash, cellular phones, and a satellite phone. More important, they had a phone that had been used briefly by Morocco's most prominent hashish producer, a phone, they hoped, that would lead them to Saladin. The second movement took place some 400 miles to the northwest in Casablanca, where two men slipped from a faded old villa, quietly so as not to awaken the demons within, and loaded their bags into a rented Peugeot sedan. They drove along the empty boulevards of the old colonial section, past the tattered Art Nouveau buildings and the modern apartment blocks of the newly rich and the bidonvilles of the wretchedly poor, until finally they reached the motorway. The younger of the two men handled the driving, the older passed the time by loading and reloading his Beretta pistol. He had no business being there, it was true. He was the chief now, and a chief had to know his place. Still, there was a first for everything. He slipped the loaded gun into the waistband of his trousers at the small of his back and checked his mobile phone. Then he stared out his window at the endless lights of Casablanca. "What are you thinking?" asked the younger man. "I'm thinking that you need to drive faster." "I've never driven a chief before," the older man smiled. "Is that all you're thinking?" "Why do you ask?" "Because it looked to me as though you were pulling a trigger."
"Which hand?"
"Left," said the younger man. "It was definitely the left."
The older man looked out the window. "How many times?"
Chapter 63. The Middle Atlas Mountains, Morocco. The phone moved steadily south, across the lowlands around Fez, toward the slopes of the Middle Atlas. They could not be sure it was actually in the possession of Nasir Ben Said. Now that the drones were gone, they had no eyes on the target, and neither the NSA nor Unit 8200 had been able to activate the phone's microphone or camera. For all they knew, the device was on the back of a flatbed truck, and Nasir Ben Said was somewhere in the labyrinth of Fez's ancient Medina. It was 1:30 in the morning when the phone reached the Berber town of Avimuzer. Its pace of travel slowed as it moved along the town's main street. Gabriel, who was receiving updates from Adrian Carter, wondered whether the brass ring was already within his reach. There was much about a place like Imuzer, he thought, for a fugitive to find appealing. It was small enough so that Westerners were easily visible, but sufficiently busy to allow a robed man to move about unnoticed. The uninhabited peaks of the Middle Atlas were close, should the fugitive feel the need to flee, and the delights of Fez were but an hour's car ride away. An image formed in Gabriel's mind, a tall, powerfully built man in a hooded jalaba, limping through the narrow alleys of the Medina. But at 1:35 a.m., the phone left Umuzer and, increasing its pace, made for Ifran, an artificial holiday town that looked as though it had been plucked from the Alps and dropped in North Africa. Once again, Gabriel allowed himself to wonder whether they were close. This time he dressed the prize in different clothing, trousers and a woolen sweater, instead of a jalaba, and imagined him passing the winter after the attack on Washington in the comfort of a Swiss-style hotel. But when the phone departed Ifran, Gabriel covered the image in a layer of obliterating paint and waited for the next update from Adrian Carter at the Black Hole.
"Faster," he said. "You have to drive faster."
"I'm driving as fast as I can," answered Yakov.
"Not you," said Gabriel. "Him."
The next town on the phone's path was Azrou. There it turned onto the N-13, the main highway linking the Middle Atlas Mountains with the Sahara, the same road on which Keller, Mikhail, Natalie, and Dina were now headed north. It passed through a chain of tiny Berber villages, Timadit, Eit Ufella, Boulajul, before finally coming to rest a few hundred yards from the town of Zaida, under what circumstances they could only imagine. A house, a fortress, a camel-hair tent in an open field strewn with boulders. 10 interminable minutes elapsed before a text message appeared on Mohammed Bakr's phone. Keller read it aloud to Gabriel. "Nazir says the brother is very badly injured. What a shame. He says he needs a doctor soon, otherwise he might not live." "The best possible outcome. You're not thinking about letting nature take its course." "Not for a minute," said Gabriel. "Tell him that the doctor is on his way. Tell him he's coming from Fez." There was a moment of silence while Natalie composed the message in Arabic and sent it. A few seconds later, Gabriel heard the ping of the reply. "Alhamdulillah," said Keller. "I couldn't agree more." Gabriel heard another ping. "What does it say?" "He wants to know where I am." "I didn't realize you two were friends." "He thinks I'm—" "Yes, I know," said Gabriel. "Tell him it took you longer than expected to arrange transport. Tell him you'll be there in 2 hours, maybe less." There was another silence while Natalie sent the message. "Any reply?" "No." "Is he working on one?" "Doesn't seem to be." "Tell him you're concerned about the brother's safety." A few seconds passed, then Keller said, "Sent. Now ask him how many brothers are with him at the Riyadh." After another exchange of messages, Keller said, 4. "Ask him whether they have guns to protect themselves from the infidels." A moment later they had their answer. "Sounds to me as though they're well armed," said Keller. "Anything else you'd like to ask?" "No more questions. The bird will be able to tell us everything else we need to know." "Where are you now?" Gabriel looked out the window at the darkened landscape. "Mars," he said gloomily. "You?" "A little village called Kerandu. It's about 60 or 70 miles from Zaida. If there are no more roadblocks, we'll be there in 90 minutes. We'll be right behind you." Gabriel severed the connection and rang the black hole at Langley. "We've got him," he told Adrian Carter. "The bird will be overhead at 4 o'clock your time." "You're sure?" "Don't worry, it's a spy satellite," said Carter. "There's not a lot of unexpected traffic up there."
Chapter 64 Zaida, Morocco. It was a drab and dusty town of low brown buildings. The shops and cafes along the wide main street were tightly shuttered, and at that hour there was no sign of life except for 3 men waiting at a crumbling bus shelter. A Jeep Cherokee filled with Western faces was worthy of their undivided attention. Their dour expressions made it clear that outsiders were not welcome, especially at 3:30 in the morning.
"Looks like Saladin's kind of place," said Keller.
"Think they know about the tall Iraqi who's been living on the east side of town?" asked Mikhail.
"I doubt it. I wouldn't mind having a look at the property while we're passing through."
"Too risky. Better to wait for the bird."
Dina drove through the rest of the town without slowing and emerged into the bleak, treeless countryside. About 1.5 miles north was a dirt road that led to a small lake, the kind of spot where a Moroccan family might spread a blanket on a cool autumn day and forget their troubles for a few hours. Dina switched off the engine while Keller rang Gabriel and told him where they could be found. A few minutes later they heard from Nazir Ben Said via text. It seemed the brother's condition was worsening. "When would the doctor arrive?"
"Soon," Natalie assured him. "Inshallah."
"Here they come," said Dina.
She flashed the headlights, and the approaching car turned off the highway and stopped. Keller and Natalie walked over and slid into the back seat. Keller checked the time on Mohammed Bakr's phone. It was 3:45.
"Fancy meeting you here. How was the drive?"
Neither Gabriel nor Yaakov responded.
Keller stared out the window. "I wonder what's keeping Mohammed and that doctor."
"Maybe he had car trouble," suggested Gabriel.
"Or left leg trouble," quipped Keller. "Or maybe he's having trouble thinking straight."
He checked the phone again. 3:46.
"Think the Moroccans have found the camp yet?"
"I'd say so."
"Think they've identified any of the victims?"
"One or two."
"Pretty big story, don't you imagine?
a major hashish producer and a French hotelier found dead together?
Almost as big as a failed American drone strike on Moroccan soil.
I wonder how long it will take to become public. Because if it does...
Keller left the thought unfinished. 3:47. Gabriel rang Carter at the stroke of 4. Another 10 minutes elapsed while the cameras and sensory devices of the satellite assessed the target.
It's a walled compound. One substantial structure, 2 smaller outbuildings.
How walled?
It's hard to tell how high it is, especially in darkness. You'll have to take a drive past the place or use your imagination.
Is the gate open or closed?
Closed, said Carter. And Nazir Ben Said's Renault is definitely there.
How many men?
2 outside, 3 inside. All in the primary structure. They're tightly grouped.
Keeping watch over an injured man.
Looks like it.
Where are they in the house?
2nd level, southeast corner.
Facing Mecca.
There's a lot of other heat in that room, said Carter. Kyle thinks it's computer equipment.
And heaven knows Kyle is never wrong.
It's possible you've found the compound where he's been directing the attacks. The crown jewels of the network are liable to be on those computers.
Are you suggesting we gather up as much as we can carry?
Might not be a bad idea.
Is there anything else you can tell me?
Looks like he's got a couple of dogs inside the walls. Big ones,
added Carter. Gabriel swore softly. His fear of the canine was well known within the International Brotherhood of Spies.
Sorry to be the bearer of bad news, said Carter sympathetically.
What kind of self-respecting Muslim extremist would keep dogs in his home?
The kind who doesn't trust cats to warn him of an intrusion. And one more thing, said Carter. The NSA has been listening in on the Moroccan police and military.
And?
They know damn well that we carried out a drone strike on their soil last night. And they know that Mohamed Bakar and Jean-Luc Martel are dead.
How long before they go public?
If I had to guess, the Moroccan people will be hearing about this over their Fruit Loops.
Then maybe we should change the subject.
We?
Let me know if there is any movement at the compound. Gabriel hung up.
Any problems? Asked Keller.
2 dogs and a locked gate.
Can't do much about the dogs, but the gate shouldn't be a problem.
Keller handed Mohamed Bakr's phone to Natalie, who composed the message and sent it to Nazir Ben Said inside the compound. The reply was a few seconds in coming.
Done, she said.
Gabriel and Yakov had carried more than just computers and secure communications equipment from the House of Spies in Casablanca. They had also taken 2 45-caliber Jericho pistols and 2 Uzi Pro compact submachine guns. Gabriel gave Yakov one of each, and Natalie an Uzi Pro. He kept only a Jericho for himself.
The perfect self-defense weapon, said Keller.
Also perfect for eliminating those who offer unwanted advice.
I don't want to get in the middle of family business, but
then don't, said Gabriel. Keller made a show of thought. How many dogs are in that compound?
Was it 1 or 2?
Gabriel said nothing.
Let Mikhail and me handle it.
Or better yet, said Keller, let's send Yakov in there alone. He looks like he's done this sort of thing a time or two.
Yakov expertly rammed a magazine into the Uzi Pro and looked at Gabriel.
He has a point, boss.
Not you, too.
That satellite can tell us only so much. What it can't tell us is whether there are spider holes in the compound or whether those boys are wearing explosive vests.
Then we should assume they are. Yakov placed a hand on Gabriel's shoulder.
You're not some kid anymore. You're the chief now. Let the 3 of us take care of it. You stay here with
the women?
I didn't mean it like that, said Yakov. But someone needs to look after them.
Dina was in the IDF, just like the rest of us. She can look after herself.
But duly noted, Yakov.
Are you going to drive or should I handle it?
Yakov hesitated, then slid behind the wheel.
Mikhail dropped into the front passenger seat, Gabriel and Keller into the back. Natalie watched the car set off toward Zaida. Then she walked over to the Jeep Cherokee and climbed into the passenger seat. She placed the Uzi Pro on the floor between her feet and checked the time on Mohamed Bakr's phone. It was 4:11.
Maybe we should listen to the news.
Dina switched on the radio
and searched the airwaves for something that sounded like a morning newscast. At the sound of a male voice, she stopped and looked at Natalie.
"He's reading verses from the Quran."
Dina rotated the tuner again. "Better?"
"Yes." "What's she talking about?"
"The weather."
"What's the forecast?"
"Hot."
"I'll say."
Natalie laughed quietly. "Do you remember that day at Nahalal?" she asked after a moment. "The day I tried to say no to all this?" Dina smiled at the memory.
"And now look at you. You're one of us."
A truck passed on the highway, then another. The stars in the eastern half of the sky were beginning to dim.
"What was he like?" asked Dina.
"Who?"
"Saladin."
"It doesn't matter."
Natalie checked the time again.
"In a few minutes, he'll be dead."
Chapter 65. Zaida, Morocco. Like small villages the world over, Zaida was not by nature a late sleeper. One of the cafes on the main square was open for business, and a smoking, fez-bound coach was taking on passengers at the shelter opposite. The stench of diesel exhaust poured into the car as Yakov, swerving to avoid a stray goat, drove past. His speed was ideal, not too fast. More important, observed Gabriel, not too slow. One hand rested lightly on the wheel, the other lay motionless on the shift. By contrast, Mikhail was drumming his fingers on the center console. Keller, however, seemed entirely oblivious to what was about to occur. Indeed, were it not for the Kalashnikov lying across his thighs, he might have been a tourist on a sightseeing excursion in an exotic land.
"Can't you at least pretend to be a little worried?" said Gabriel.
"About what?"
"That gun, for one thing. It looks a museum piece."
"A damn fine weapon, the Kalashnikov. Besides, it worked just fine at the camp in the desert. Just ask your friend Dmitri Antonov. He'll tell you." But Mikhail wasn't listening. He was still drumming his fingers on the console.
"Is there any way you can make him stop?" asked Keller.
"I've tried."
"Try harder."
Yakov removed his right hand from the shift and placed it atop Mikhail's. The fingers went still.
"Much obliged," said Keller.
A few yards beyond the square, the town dwindled. They crossed a dry creek bed and entered another region separating civilization and wilderness. A few broken buildings rose from the brown earth on both sides of the highway, and off to the east, an island in a sea of stones was the compound. From a distance it was impossible to tell what it was. A home? A factory? A secret government installation, the hiding place of the world's most dangerous terrorist? Its outer walls looked to be about 10 or 12 feet high and were topped by spirals of concertina wire. The private track connecting it to the highway was unpaved, ensuring that any approaching vehicle would make a great deal of noise and raise a cloud of dust. Gabriel brought a phone to his ear. It was connected to Adrian Carter at Langley.
"Can you see us?"
"You're hard to miss."
"Any change?"
"Two outside, three inside.
They're in the same room. One of them hasn't moved in a while."
Gabriel lowered the phone. Yakov was staring at him in the rearview mirror.
"Once we make the turn," he said, "we lose all element of surprise."
"But we're not going to surprise them, Yakov. We're expected."
Yakov guided the car onto the private road and started toward the compound.
"Switch on your high beams," instructed Gabriel.
Yakov did as he was told, illuminating the harsh, rocky landscape with white light.
"They see us now."
Gabriel raised a second phone to his ear, the one connected to Natalie, and told her to ring the doorbell. Natalie had preloaded the text onto Mohammed Bakr's phone. Now, on Gabriel's command, she thumbed it into the ether.
"Well?" he asked.
"He's working on a reply."
The message finally appeared.
"He says they'll open the gate."
"How nice of them. But tell them to hurry. The doctor is very anxious to see the brother."
Natalie sent the message on Bakr's Samsung, then she switched her own phone to speaker mode and waited for the sound of gunfire. By then, Gabriel was already talking to Adrian Carter at Langley.
"Any change? Two men getting ready to open the gate, one coming downstairs. Looks like he's carrying a gun."
"So much for Arab hospitality," said Gabriel, and lowered the phone. They were about 50 yards from the compound, and closing at a moderate speed. The headlamps now shone directly on the gate. It was a 2-leaf swing model, stainless steel. A cloud of dust settled around them like fog as Yakov slowed to a stop. For several seconds, nothing happened. Gabriel raised the Langley phone to his ear. "What's going on?"
"Looks like they're unlocking it."
"Where's the third man?"
"Waiting outside the entrance of the house."
"And where's the entrance relative to us?"
"You're 2 o'clock.
Gabriel lowered the phone again as a crack appeared between the leaves of the gate. He relayed the satellite information to the other 3 men in the car and issued a terse set of instructions. Keller frowned.
"Mind saying that again in a language I can understand?"
Gabriel hadn't realized he was speaking in Hebrew. All at once the gate began to swing away, drawn by 2 pairs of hands. Yakov balanced the Uzi Pro atop the steering wheel and aimed at the pair of hands to the right. Mikhail leveled a Kalashnikov at the hands on the left.
"Never mind," said Keller. "No translation necessary."
At last, the gate was sufficiently open to accommodate a car. 2 men, each cradling an automatic rifle, stepped into the breach and waved Yakov into the compound. Instead, he unleashed a torrent of fire through the windscreen toward the man on the right. Mikhail, in the front passenger seat, squeezed off several rounds with a Kalashnikov toward the man on the left. Neither guard managed to fire a shot in return, but as Yakov accelerated through the open gate, a gun opened up from the entrance of the main building. Mikhail answered through the open front passenger window, while Gabriel, directly behind him, fired off several rounds with the Jericho 45. Within seconds, the gun in the entranceway fell silent. Yakov braked hard and rammed the shift into park while Mikhail and Gabriel tumbled out of the car and started across the outer yard of the compound. Mikhail quickly drew away from Gabriel, and after a few paces Keller overtook him as well. The 2 elite soldiers paused briefly at the entrance next to the body of the 3rd gunman. Gabriel glanced down at the lifeless face. It was Nazir Ben Said. Beyond the entrance was an ornate Moorish courtyard, blue with moonlight, with cedar doors on all 4 sides. Keller and Mikhail pivoted through the doorway on the right and crossed a foyer to a stone flight of steps. Instantly they were met with automatic weapons fire from above. The 2 operatives dived for cover, right and left, while Gabriel remained pinned down outside in the courtyard. When the gunfire ceased, he slipped into the foyer and sheltered next to Mikhail. Keller, directly opposite, wedged his Kalashnikov into the stairwell and blindly fired several shots into the darkness. Then Mikhail did the same. When they paused to reload, there was only silence from above. Gabriel peered around the edge of the wall. The landing at the top of the steps appeared empty, but in the darkness he couldn't be sure. Finally, Keller and Mikhail mounted the 1st step. At once, there was a piercing scream, a woman's scream, thought Gabriel, 2 religiously significant Arabic words that left little doubt as to what would occur next. He grabbed the back of Mikhail's shirt and pulled with every bit of strength he had left in his body while Keller hurled himself down the steps toward safety. A second too late, the bomb exploded. Saladin, it seemed, had lost his sense of timing. Gabriel was carrying 2 mobile phones in the pocket of his jacket, 1 connected to Adrian Carter, the other to Natalie and Dina. Carter and the rest of the officers gathered in the black hole had the advantage of the satellite's cameras and sensors, but Natalie and Dina had been privy only to the audio. The quality was muted. Even so, they had no trouble making out what was taking place inside the compound. A brief but intense firefight, a woman screaming Allahu Akbar, the unmistakable sound of a bomb exploding. After that, there was only silence. Dina quickly started the engine. A moment later they were racing along the main street of Zaida. The little town in the shadow of the Middle Atlas Mountains was now wide awake. The steps were strewn with the tattered remnants of a woman, smallish, about 20 or 25. Pretty, once. Here a leg, here a portion of a torso, here a hand, the right, still clutching a detonator switch. The head had rolled to the bottom of the steps and come to rest at Gabriel's feet. He lifted the black veil from the face and saw a set of delicate features arranged in a mask of religious madness. The eyes were blue,
the blue of a mountain lake. Was she a wife, or concubine, or a daughter, perhaps? Or was she just another black widow, a lost girl to whom Saladin had strapped a bomb and an ideology of death? Gabriel closed the blue eyes and covered the face, and followed Keller and Mikhail silently up the stairs. A Kalashnikov lay on the upper landing, where it had fallen from the woman's hands, along with a magazine's worth of shell casings. To the right, a hallway stretched into the darkness. At the end of it was a door. And behind the door, thought Gabriel, was a room at the southeast corner of the house. A room facing Mecca. A room where an injured man now lay alone, with no one to protect him. They picked their way carefully across the landing, so as not to disturb the shell casings, and moved silently along the corridor. When they reached the door, Keller tested the latch. It was locked. He exchanged a few quick hand signals with Mikhail, and motioned for Gabriel to move away. But Gabriel quickly overruled him with a signal of his own. He was an operational chief, and he preferred to deal with his enemies at a meter rather than a mile. Keller didn't argue. There wasn't time. Instead, he kicked down the door and then followed Gabriel and Mikhail inside. Saladin lay on a bare mattress in the darkest corner, his face lit by the glow of a mobile phone. Startled, he reached for the Kalashnikov at his side. Gabriel sprinted toward him, the Jericho in his outstretched hands, and fired 11 shots into Saladin's heart. Then he reached down and snatched up the fallen phone. It was vibrating with an incoming message. Inshallah, it will be done. Chapter 66 Morocco, London. Saladin had made his last stand not with a gun, but with a Nokia 5 Android phone. There were more scattered around him, along with several Samsung Galaxies and iPhones, 8 laptop computers, and dozens of flash drives. Mikhail and Keller quickly loaded the devices into a duffel bag while Gabriel snapped a photo of Saladin's lifeless face. It was not a trophy. He wanted to prove definitively that the monster was gone and thus deliver a body blow not only to the Islamic State, but to the entire global jihadist movement. Dina and Natalie were turning through the open gate of the compound when Gabriel, Mikhail, and Keller exited the house. Yakov was digging another Nokia 5 from the pocket of Nazir Ben Said. The rented Peugeot was not fit for the road, not with the blown-out windscreen and the bullet holes from stem to stern, so they all piled into the Jeep Cherokee instead. In total, from forceful entry to hasty departure, they were inside the compound for less than 5 minutes. Evidently, the sound of the gunfire and the explosion had reached the center of Zaida. As they sped along the town's main street, they were met by a few stares, some curious, others manifestly hostile, but no one tried to stop them. It was not until they reached the tiny Berber hamlet of Eight Ufala, some 10 miles down the mountain, that they spotted the first gendarme coming up the valley. The unit swept past without slowing, and continued on towards Zaida. In 20 minutes, perhaps less, they would enter the compound, and, in a room on the second floor of the house, they would find a large, powerfully built Arab lying alone, with 11 bullet holes in the front of his jalaba. Had he been capable of speech, he would have done so with a distinct Iraqi accent, and had he been ambulatory, he would have walked with a limp. He had lived a life of violence, and had died accordingly. But had he, in his final seconds, ordered another attack? One last curtain call. Inshallah, it will be done. It was possible the answer, along with other critical intelligence, resided somewhere in the mobile phones, computers, and flash drives they had taken from Saladin's room. Therefore, it was essential that the devices not end up in the hands of the Moroccans, who would be more interested in solving the riddle of a long and violent night than in preventing the next attack. Still, Gabriel decreed that theirs would not be a fighting retreat. There had been enough bloodshed already. And now that Saladin was dead, the Moroccans were less likely to throw a diplomatic temper tantrum or do something stupid like prosecuting the chief of the Israeli Secret Intelligence Service for murder. It was approaching 7 when they reached Fez. They headed north through the Rif Mountains, toward the Mediterranean coast. The boat hull was at El Jebba, but it could not be utilized until after dark, when it would be safe to bring the Zodiacs ashore. That meant an entire day, perhaps longer, would be lost before the technicians could begin scrubbing the phones and computers for intelligence. Gabriel decided they would leave Morocco by ferry instead. The port of Tangier was the most obvious choice. There were regular ferries to Spain, France, and even Italy. But to the east was a smaller port with service directly to the British overseas territory of Gibraltar. They boarded the 12:15 with minutes to spare. Gabriel and Keller stood at the railing in sunlight, Keller smoking a cigarette, Gabriel holding a mobile phone as the white limestone cliffs of Gibraltar's famous rock appeared before them.
"Home at last," said Keller.
But Gabriel wasn't listening. He was staring at the photo he had snapped of Saladin's lifeless face.
"Best picture he's ever taken," said Keller.
Gabriel permitted himself a brief smile. Then he fired the photo securely to Adrian Carter at Langley. Carter's reply was instant.
"What does it say?" asked Keller.
"Alhamdulillah."
Keller dropped his cigarette into the sea.
"We'll see about that."
From Gibraltar's ferry terminal, it was only a short walk along Winston Churchill Avenue to the airport, where a chartered Falcon 2000 executive jet was waiting, courtesy of Her Majesty's Secret Intelligence Service. Graham Seymour had stocked the plane with several bottles of excellent French champagne, but no one on board was in any mood for a celebration. Once the plane was airborne, they started switching on the captured phones and computers. All were locked, as were the flash drives. It was late afternoon when they sat down at London City Airport in the Docklands. Two vehicles were waiting, a panel van and a black Jaguar limousine. The van took Mikhail, Yakov, Dina, and Natalie to Heathrow, where they would catch a late-departing flight for Ben-Gurion. Gabriel and Keller rode in the Jaguar to Vauxhall Cross, along with a duffel bag. They entered the building through the underground parking garage and carried the bag into Graham Seymour's office. Seymour had arrived from Washington a few hours earlier. He looked only slightly better than Gabriel and Keller.
"Amanda Wallace and I have agreed to a division of labor regarding the phones and computers. SIS will take half, and five will get the rest. Our respective labs are fully staffed and ready to go."
"I'm surprised you were able to keep the Americans at bay," replied Gabriel.
"We weren't. The agency and the FBI are sending liaison officers to look over our shoulders. In case you were wondering," added Seymour, "it was really him. The agency confirmed it with an 8-point facial analysis."
He offered a hand to Gabriel.
"Honor is due. Congratulations. And thank you."
Gabriel reluctantly accepted Seymour's hand.
"Don't thank me, Graham. Thank him."
He nodded toward Keller.
"And Olivia, of course. We would never have been able to get close to Saladin without her."
"The Royal Navy plucked her off that ersatz cargo ship of yours about an hour ago," said Seymour. "Needless to say, it is essential we keep her role a closely guarded secret."
"That might be difficult."
"Quite," said Seymour. "The Internet is already burning up with rumors that Saladin is dead. The White House is eager to make a formal announcement before the Moroccans beat them to the punch."
"When?"
"In time for the evening news. They were wondering whether the office wanted any of the credit."
"God, no."
"They were hoping you would say that. The Moroccans will eventually get over an invasion of their sovereignty by the Americans, but the Israelis are another matter entirely."
"What about the British?"
"We're legally forbidden to take part in targeted killing operations, therefore we will say nothing." Seymour looked at Keller.
"Even so, the debriefers are keen to have a word with you. The lawyers, too."
"That," said Keller, "would be a very bad idea."
"Were you the one who—"
"No," said Keller.
"No such luck."
It was 6 that evening when the experts commenced work on the captured devices. MI5 was the first to break into a phone, MI6 a computer. As expected, all the documents were heavily encrypted. But by 7 o'clock, technicians from both services were unbuttoning the documents at will and handing them off to the analytical teams to sift for vital clues. The first batch was low-grade stuff,
but Gabriel and Keller, who were monitoring the search from Graham Seymour's office, warned against complacency. They had seen the look in Saladin's eyes as he was dispatching his final text. At 9 o'clock London time, the American president and CIA director Morris Payne strode into the White House briefing room to announce that the ISIS terror mastermind known as Saladin had been killed overnight in a clandestine U.S. operation in the Middle Atlas Mountains of Morocco. It seemed his death was the result of a painstaking American effort to deliver justice to the man who had perpetrated the attack on Washington, and was evidence of the new administration's determination to wipe out radical Islamic terrorism once and for all. The Moroccans had known of the operation in advance and had provided valuable assistance, but otherwise it was an American undertaking from beginning to end. And the results, boasted the president, speak for themselves. No regrets? Asked Seymour. No, answered Gabriel. I prefer to come and go without being seen. When the president and his CIA director were finished, the reporters and the rented terrorism experts quickly tried to fill in the many gaps in the official account. Unfortunately for them, most of their information came directly from Adrian Carter and his staff, which meant little of it bore even a passing resemblance to the truth. By 10:30, Gabriel and Keller had had enough. Exhausted, they climbed into the Jaguar limousine and headed across the river to West London. Keller went to his opulent home in Kensington, Gabriel to the old office safe flat on Bayswater Road, overlooking Hyde Park. Entering, he heard a woman singing softly to herself in Italian. He closed the door and smiled. Chiara always sang when she was happy. Chapter 67 Bayswater, London. Where are the children?
Who?
The children, Gabriel repeated deliberately. Irene and Raphael. Our children.
I left them with the Shamrons.
You mean you left them with Gila? Ari can barely look after himself.
They'll be fine.
Gabriel accepted a glass of chilled gavi and sat down on a stool at the kitchen counter. Chiara washed and dried a packet of mushrooms, and with a few deft movements of her knife, reduced them to rows of perfect slices. Don't cook, said Gabriel. It's too late to eat.
It's never too late to eat, darling. Besides, you look like you can use some food.
She wrinkled her nose.
And a shower.
Hamid and Tarek said if I showered, I would disturb the jinns.
Who are Hamid and Tarek?
Unwitting employees of Israeli intelligence.
And the jinns?
Gabriel explained.
I wish I could have been there with you.
I'm glad you weren't. Chiara tossed the mushrooms into a sauté pan, and a moment later the smell of warm olive oil filled the air. Gabriel drank some of the gavi. How did you know we were coming to London?
A contact inside the office.
Does this contact of yours have a name?
He prefers to remain anonymous.
Of course.
He's a former chief. Very important.
She gave the pan a shake, and the mushrooms began to sizzle. When I heard you and the team were making a run for Gibraltar, I stowed away on a flight to London.
Housekeeping was kind enough to put a few things in the fridge.
Why didn't anyone tell the current chief about this?
I asked them not to. I wanted it to be a surprise.
She smiled.
Didn't you notice my bodyguards down on Bayswater Road?
I was too tired to look.
Your tradecraft is starting to slip, darling. They say it happens to those who spend too much time behind a desk.
I doubt Saladin would agree with you.
Really? Chiara glanced at the television playing silently on the counter. Because the BBC says it is all an American operation.
The Americans, said Gabriel, were very helpful. But we were the ones who got him, with significant help from Christopher Keller.
And to think, he tried to kill you once.
She drank some of Gabriel's wine. How much did Uzi tell you about what happened?
Very little, actually. I know the drone strike didn't go as planned, and that you managed to track Saladin to a compound up in the mountains. After that, things get a little fuzzy.
For me, too, said Gabriel.
Were you there?
He hesitated, then nodded slowly.
Were you the one who...
Does it matter? She said nothing.
Yes, said Gabriel. It was me. I was the one who killed him. And then he told her the rest of it. The woman who had detonated herself in the stairwell, the room full of phones and computers in which Saladin had spent his last hours, the final text message, Inshallah, it will be done.
It was probably just talk, said Kiara.
From a man who nearly managed to smuggle a shipment of cesium chloride into France. Enough cesium chloride to build several dirty bombs. Bombs that would make the center of a city uninhabitable for years. He paused, then added, You see my point. Kiara waited until the mushrooms had shed their water before seasoning them with salt and pepper and freshly chopped thyme. Then she dropped several bundles of dried fettuccine into a pot of boiling water.
How long are you planning to stay in London? She asked.
Until the British have finished scrubbing the phones and the computers we took from the compound.
You're worried he's coming after us?
His first target was the Isaac Weinberg Center for the Study of Anti-Semitism in France. It's better for me to stay here while the intelligence is being processed. It's less likely that something will slip through the cracks.
But no more heroics, she cautioned.
No, said Gabriel. I'm the chief now.
You were the chief when you were in Morocco, too.
She tested a strand of the fettuccine. Then she looked around the little kitchen and smiled.
You know, I've always loved this apartment. We've had good times here, Gabriel.
And bad ones, too.
We were married here. Do you remember?
It wasn't a real wedding.
I thought it was. Her expression darkened. I remember it all so clearly. It was the night before.
Her voice trailed off. To the sauté pan she added wine and cream. Then she poured the mixture over the fettuccine and tossed in grated cheese. She prepared only a single portion and placed it before Gabriel. He plunged a fork into it and twirled. None for you? He asked.
Oh, no. Kiara glanced at her wristwatch. It's much too late to eat.
Gabriel had used the safe flat so often that his clothing hung in the closet and his toiletries filled the bathroom cabinet. After finishing a second portion of the pasta, he showered and shaved and fell, exhausted, into bed next to Kiara. He had hoped his sleep would be dreamless, but that was not to be the case. He climbed an endless flight of steps that were drenched in blood and littered with the remains of a woman. And when he found the head and moved aside the veil, it was Kiara's face he saw. Inshallah, it will be done. Shortly before 5 o'clock, he awoke suddenly, as if startled by the sound of a bomb. It was only his mobile phone, which was shimmying across the surface of the bedside table. He brought it swiftly to his ear and listened in silence. Rising, he dressed in darkness. And to the darkness, he returned. Chapter 68 Thames House, London. The Jaguar limousine was waiting downstairs on the Bayswater Road. It delivered Gabriel not to Vauxhall Cross, but to Thames House, the headquarters of MI5. Miles Kent, the deputy director, escorted him quickly upstairs to Amanda Wallace's suite. She looked worn and tired, and was obviously under a great deal of stress. Graham Seymour was there, too, still dressed in the same suit he'd been wearing the night before, absent the club tie. Junior officers were rushing in and out of the room, and there was a secure video conference up and running to Scotland Yard and Downing Street. The fact that they were gathered here instead of across the river could mean only one thing. Someone had found proof on Saladin's phones and computers that an attack was imminent, and London was once again the target. "How long have you known?" asked Gabriel. "We unearthed the first nugget around 2 o'clock this morning," said Seymour. "Why didn't anyone tell me?" "We thought you could use a bit of sleep. Besides, it's our problem, not yours." "Where?"
"Westminster."
"When?"
"Later this morning," said Seymour. "We think around 9.
"What's the method of attack?"
"Suicide bomber."
"Do you know his identity?"
"We're still working on that."
"Just one, you sure?"
"So it would seem."
"Why only one?"
Seymour handed Gabriel a stack of printouts.
"Because one is all they need."
The text message had been dispatched at 3:15 the previous morning, Morocco time, when the likely sender had been under emotional distress and in physical pain. As a result, it had lacked the network's normal secondary and tertiary encryption protocols, thus allowing an MI5 computer technician to unearth it from one of the phones taken from the Zaida compound. The language was coded but unmistakable. It was an order to carry out a martyrdom operation. There was no mention of a target, but the apparent haste with which the message was sent allowed the technician to find related communications and documents that made the objective of the attack and the time it was to be carried out abundantly clear. Numerous casing photos had been found, and even a document discussing prevailing winds and the likely dispersal pattern of the radiological material. The planners hoped, God willing, for an area of nuclear contamination stretching from Trafalgar Square to Thames House itself. MI5's own experts, who had studied similar scenarios, predicted that such an attack would render the seat of British power uninhabitable for months, if not years. The economic cost, not to mention the psychological toll, would be catastrophic. The recipient of the message had been more cautious than the sender. Still, the sender's early mistake had effectively nullified the recipient's care. As a result, the MI5 technician had been able to locate the entire exchange of messages along with a martyrdom video. The subject addressed the camera in a London accent with his face concealed. MI5's linguistics experts reckoned he was from North London, that he was native-born and likely of Egyptian ancestry. With the help of GCHQ, Britain's Signals Intelligence Service, MI5 was frantically comparing the man's voice to known Islamic radicals. What's more, MI5 and SO13, the counterterrorism command of the Metropolitan Police, were monitoring known extremists and suspected members of ISIS. In short, the entire national security apparatus of the United Kingdom was in quiet but efficient panic mode. By 6 o'clock, as the skies beyond Amanda's windows were beginning to brighten, all efforts to identify and locate the suspected suicide bomber had proven fruitless. Prime Minister Jonathan Lancaster, in the cabinet room at number 10, convened a video conference at 5:30. He opened it with a question no counterterrorism professional ever wanted to hear. "Should we cordon off Westminster and order an evacuation of the surrounding districts?" One by one, his senior ministers, civil servants, intelligence chiefs, and police commissioners gave their answers. Their recommendation was unanimous. Close Westminster, shut down all rail, bus, and commuter traffic into central London. Begin an orderly and thorough evacuation. "And what if it's a hoax or a bluff? Or what if it's based on bad intelligence? We'll look like Chicken Little, and the next time we say the sky is falling, no one will believe us." The intelligence, everyone agreed, was as good and timely as it gets, and they were rapidly running out of other options to prevent a monumental disaster. The Prime Minister's eyes narrowed.
"Is that you I see, Mr. Alon?"
"It is, Prime Minister."
"And what say you?"
"It's not my place, sir."
"Please don't stand on ceremony. You and I know each other too well for that. Besides, there isn't time."
"In my opinion," said Gabriel carefully, "it would be a mistake to order closures and evacuations."
"Why?"
"Because you'll lose your one and only chance to stop the attack."
"Which is?"
"You know the time and place it will occur. And if you try to cordon off the center of London, you'll incite mass panic, and the suicide bomber will simply choose a secondary target."
"Go on,"
instructed the Prime Minister. "Keep the entrances to Westminster wide open. Place CBRN teams and undercover SCO-19 firearms officers at strategic points around Parliament and Whitehall."
"Let him walk straight into a trap. Is that what you're saying?"
"Exactly, Prime Minister. He won't be hard to miss. He'll be overdressed for the summer weather, and the detonator would be visible in one of his hands. He'll probably be sweating with nerves and reciting prayers. He might even be suffering from radiation sickness. And when he walks past a Geiger counter," said Gabriel in conclusion, "he'll light it up. Just make sure the firearms officer who goes after him has the nerve and experience to do what's necessary."
"Any candidates?"
asked the Prime Minister.
"Only two," said Gabriel.
Chapter 69 Parliament Square, London.
I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Or the end of one.
Why are you always so fatalistic? Asked Keller. We're not in the Sahara any more. We're in the middle of London.
Yes, said Gabriel, looking around. What could possibly go wrong here?
They were seated on a bench at the western edge of Parliament